people exchanged tentative looks. Fergus tiptoed to the bear, sat down, and leaned carefully against him. The bear's fur was luxuriously soft, and his body radiated heat. He didn't seem to mind Fergus leaning against him at all. One by one, the people approached. The children and the elderly snuggled right against the bear. The women nestled next to them, and ringing the outside were the men. Miraculously, though some were toastier than others, everyone survived the night. The next day, the bear and the people were eating fish when another iceberg came floating past. There were three polar bears on it, and when the people's bear saw them, he stood up and roared.
"Hey, fellas," he seemed to say, "there's a boy here who can get us as many fish as we like. Come on over."
The three bears dove into the water and swam right over.
"Oh, great," one of the men said. "Now there are four bears on our iceberg."
"Don't worry," Fergus replied. "There's plenty of fish for everyone. They won't bother us."
The bears spent the day feasting on fish, and when darkness fell, they slept together in a big pile. The people nestled among them. That night, everyone was warm as could be, men, women, and children. The following day, another three bears swam over from a passing iceberg, and the day after that, four more came. The people were starting to get nervous.
11 bears are a lot of bears," a woman said to Fergus. "What happens when they run out of fish to eat?"
"I'll catch more,"
Fergus replied. He spent all that day and the next one staring out to sea, watching for another school of fish to appear, but he didn't see any. Their supply of fish was nearly gone. Now even Fergus was starting to worry.
"We should have killed that bear when there was only the one," an old man grumbled. "Instead, that peculiar boy brought us 10 more, and now look at the mess we're in."
Fergus could feel the people beginning to turn on him. He wondered what would happen when the fish ran out. Perhaps they would feed him to the bears. That night they went to sleep in a contented and furry pile, but in the morning the people awoke to find 11 polar bears staring at them hungrily, having finished every last fish on the iceberg. Fergus ran to the end of the iceberg and cast his gaze desperately out to sea. What he saw made his heart leap for joy. But it wasn't a school of fish. It was land. In the distance was a snowy island. Better still, Fergus could see smoke rising from it, which meant it was inhabited. There would be people there and food. Forgetting the danger of the bears for a moment, Fergus ran back to tell everyone the news. They were unimpressed.
"What good is land if we get eaten before we can reach it?" a man said.
And then a bear approached him, picked him up by one leg, and shook him, as if hoping a fish might fall out of his pockets. The man screamed, but before the frustrated bear could take a bite of him, a gunshot rang out. Everyone turned to see a man in white furs holding a rifle. He fired a second time, right over the bear's head, and the bear dropped the dangling man and ran away. Then the rest of the bears ran away too. The man in furs had seen them through a spyglass from the island, he explained, and had come to rescue them. He gestured for the crowd to follow him and brought them to a hidden cove in the iceberg, where a flotilla of small, sturdy rowboats was waiting. The crowd wept with gratitude as they were ushered onto the boats and rowed to safety. Fergus was thankful too, but as they crossed the water, he grew nervous that someone would tell the rescuer about his talent. It was bad enough that so many people already knew what he could do. But no one said a word about him, or to him. In fact, most of the people wouldn't even meet his eyes, and those who did gave him nasty looks, as if they blamed him for all their misfortunes. His mother had been right, Fergus thought bitterly. Sharing his secret had only ever caused him trouble. It made people see him as an object, a tool to be used when it suited them, and then tossed away when he was no longer needed, and he resolved never, ever to share his talent again.
no matter what. The boats docked at a small harbour ringed by timber houses. Smoke rose from their chimneys, and the smell of cooking food hung in the air. The promise of a hot meal by a warm hearth seemed tantalizingly close. The man in furs tied his boat and stepped out onto the dock.
"Welcome to Pelt Island," he said.
With a sudden chill, Fergus realized where he'd heard that name before. It was the fur trading island Captain Shaw had been trying to reach when they were wrecked on the iceberg. Before he'd quite wrapped his mind around this, he saw something on the dock that astounded him even more. A weather-beaten lifeboat with the word Hannah on the side. The captain and his men had reached the island after all. They were here. A moment later, someone else noticed the lifeboat. Word spread quickly through the crowd, and soon a mob of angry people was demanding to know where Captain Shaw and his men were.
"They left us to die," a woman shouted.
"They threatened us with pistols when we tried to save our children," a man cried.
"They made us eat mouse droppin' soup," said a scrawny young boy.
The man dressed in furs tried to calm them down, but the people were bent on revenge. They snatched his rifle, stormed into town, and discovered Captain Shaw and his men in the tavern, drunk as skunks. A savage fight erupted. The crowd fought the captain and his men with anything they could find, rocks, pieces of furniture, even flaming logs pulled from the hearth. They were outgunned, but the captain and his men were badly outnumbered, and finally, beaten and decimated, they fled into the snowy hills above the town. The passengers had won. Several of them had been killed, but they had settled the score with evil Captain Shaw, and they'd reached dry land and civilization in the bargain. There was much to celebrate, but their cries of victory were soon interrupted by cries for help. A fire had broken out. The man in furs came running.
"You idiot, set our town on fire!" he shouted at the crowd.
"Well, put it out, then," replied an exhausted fighter.
"We can't," the man said. "It's the fire station that's burning."
They tried to help the fur traders fight the fire with buckets of seawater from the harbour, but there weren't enough buckets, and the flames were spreading fast. In desperation, the crowd turned to Fergus for help.
"Can't you do something about this?" they begged him.
He tried to say no. He'd promised himself he would refuse. But when their pleas turned to threats, Fergus found himself in an impossible situation.
"Fine, then," he said angrily. "Stand back."
Once everyone had retreated to high ground, Fergus used all his strength and power to summon a giant wave from the ocean. It crashed into the town and put out all the fires, but as the great surge of water retreated again, it lifted the houses from their foundations and took them along with it. The crowd watched in horror as the whole town was swept into the sea. Fergus ran for his life. The crowd, furious, chased him through the streets and up into the hills, where he was finally able to evade them by hiding in a snowbank. When they had gone, he got out, frozen to the bone, and stumbled through the wilderness. After a few hours, Fergus happened upon some men in the woods. It was the captain and his first mate. The captain leaned against the base of a tree, his shirt soaked with blood. He was dying. Shaw laughed when he saw Fergus.
"So they turned on you, too? I suppose that makes us brothers in arms."
"No, it doesn't," Fergus said. "I'm not like you. You're a monster."
"I'm just a man," the captain said. "It's you they consider a monster. And what people think of you is all that really matters."
"But all I've ever tried to do is to help people," said Fergus.
After he'd said it, though, he wondered if it was really true. The ungrateful crowd had been threatening him when he summoned a wave to douse the fires. Had he, in his anger, created a larger wave than was needed? Had a small, dark part of him destroyed the town on purpose? Maybe he was a monster.
He decided the only thing to do was to seek a life of permanent solitude. Fergus left the captain to die and walked down the hills toward the town. Night was falling as he slipped through the ruined streets, and no one saw him. He looked for a boat at the docks that he might use, but they had all been unmoored and scattered out to sea by the great wave. He jumped in the water and swam out to something that appeared in the darkness to be a large, flipped-over boat, but it turned out to be one of the town's wooden houses, floating on its side. He crawled in through the front door, summoned a wave to right the house, and rowed it out to sea, due south. For days he pushed his houseboat farther and farther south, eating fish that flopped through the front door. After a week he stopped seeing icebergs. After two, the weather began to warm. After 3 weeks, the frost cleared from his windows, the seas grew calm, and a tropical breeze began to blow through the windows. The house still had much of its furniture. During the day, he sat in an easy chair and read books. When he wanted to sunbathe, he climbed out the window and lay on the roof. At night, he got into bed and was lulled to sleep by the gentle rocking of the waves. He drifted for weeks, perfectly content with his new life of solitude. Then one day he saw a ship on the horizon. He had no interest in meeting anyone new, and tried to steer the house away from it, but the ship turned in his direction, sails billowing, and quickly overtook him. It was a formidable-looking schooner, with three masts, and it towered over the house. A rope ladder was tossed over the side. It seemed the ship wasn't going to leave him alone, and Fergus decided he may as well climb aboard, tell the crew he didn't need rescuing, and send them on their way. But when he topped the ladder and clambered onto the deck, he was surprised to find the deck empty save one person, a girl about his age. She had dark hair and brown skin, and she was giving Fergus a very hard look. "What are you doing in a house in the middle of the ocean?" she asked him.
"Escaping from an island in the icy north," Fergus replied.
"And how did you keep the house afloat?" she asked, suspiciously. "And get all this way without a sail?"
"Just lucky, I guess," Fergus said.
"That's ridiculous," said the girl. "Tell me the truth."
"I'm sorry," Fergus said, "but my mother told me never to talk about it."
The girl narrowed her eyes at him, as if considering whether or not to throw him overboard. Fergus avoided her gaze and glanced nervously over her shoulder.
"Where's the captain?"
he asked.
"You're looking at her,"
the girl replied.
"Oh,"
said Fergus, unable to hide his surprise.
"Well, where's your crew?"
"You're looking at them," she said. Fergus could hardly believe it.
"You mean to tell me you sailed this huge ship all the way from Cabo Verde?"
the girl said.
"All the way from Cabo Verde? By yourself?"
"Yes, I did," the girl said.
"How?"
"I'm sorry," she said, "but my mother told me never to talk about it." And then she turned her back on him and raised her arms, and a great wind blew up and billowed the sails. She was smiling when she turned around again. "My name's Cesaria," she said, and put out her hand. Fergus was stunned. He'd never met anyone like himself before.
"Nice to meet you,"
he stuttered, and shook her hand.
"I'm Fergus."
"Hey, Fergus, your house is floating away." Fergus spun around to see the house drifting away from the ship. Then a rather large wave hit the house, and it tipped over and began to sink. Fergus didn't mind. He'd already decided he didn't need the house any more.
In fact, it just might have been Fergus himself who made the wave that sunk the house. "Well, I guess I'm stuck here," he said, and shrugged.
"That's okay with me," Cesaria said, and grinned.
"Excellent,"
Fergus said, and grinned back. And the two peculiar children stood grinning at each other a long time
because they knew they had finally found someone to share their secrets with. The Tale of Cuthbert. Once upon a peculiar time, in a forest deep and ancient, there roamed a great many animals. There were rabbits and deer and foxes, just as there are in every forest. But there were animals of a less common sort, too, like stilt-legged grim bears and two-headed lynxes and talking emu ruffs. These peculiar animals were a favourite target of hunters, who loved to shoot them and mount them on walls and show them off to their hunter friends, but loved even more to sell them to zookeepers, who would lock them in cages and charge money to view them. Now, you might think it would be far better to be locked in a cage than to be shot and mounted on a wall, but peculiar creatures must roam free to be happy, and after a while the spirits of caged ones wither, and they begin to envy their wall-mounted friends. This was an age when giants still roamed the earth, as they did in the long-ago olden times, though they were few in number and diminishing. And it just so happened that one of these giants lived near the forest. He was very kind and spoke very softly and ate only plants. His name was Cuthbert. One day, Cuthbert came into the forest to gather berries, and there saw a hunter hunting an emu ruff. Being the kindly giant that he was, Cuthbert picked up the little ruff by the scruff of its long neck, and by standing up to his full height, on tiptoe, which he rarely did because it made all his old bones crackle, Cuthbert was able to reach up very high and deposit the emu ruff on a mountain top, well out of danger. Then, just for good measure, he squashed the hunter to jelly between his toes. Word of Cuthbert's kindness spread throughout the forest, and soon peculiar animals were coming to him every day, asking to be lifted up to the mountain top and out of danger. And Cuthbert said, "I'll protect you, little brothers and sisters. All I ask in return is that you talk to me and keep me company. There aren't many giants left in the world, and I get lonely from time to time." And they said, "We will, Cuthbert, we will." So every day Cuthbert saved more peculiar animals from the hunters, lifting them up to the mountain by the scruffs of their necks, until there was a whole peculiar menagerie up there. And the animals were happy there, because they could finally live in peace. And Cuthbert was happy too, because if he stood on his tiptoes and rested his chin on the top of the mountain, he could talk to his new friends all he liked. Then one morning, a witch came to see Cuthbert. The giant was bathing in a little lake in the shadow of the mountain, when she said to him, "I'm terribly sorry, but I've got to turn you into stone."
"Why would you do that?" asked the giant. "I'm very kindly, a helping sort of giant."
And she said,
"I was hired by the family of the hunter you squashed."
"Ah," he replied, "forgot about him."
"I'm terribly sorry,"
the witch said again, and then she waved a birch branch at him, and poor Cuthbert turned to stone. All of a sudden, Cuthbert became very heavy, so heavy that he began to sink into the lake. He sank and sank, and didn't stop sinking until he was covered in water all the way up to his neck. His animal friends saw what was happening, and though they felt terrible about it, they decided they could do nothing to help him.
"I know you can't save me,"
Cuthbert shouted up to his friends,
"but at least come and talk to me. I'm stuck down here, and so very lonely."
"But if we come down there, the hunters will shoot us," they called back. Cuthbert knew they were right, but still he pleaded with them.
"Talk to me," he cried. "Please come and talk to me."
The animals tried singing and shouting to poor Cuthbert from the safety of their cliff-top, but they were too distant and their voices too small, so that even to Cuthbert and his giant ears They sounded quieter than the whisper of leaves in the wind.
"Talk to me,"
he begged.
"Come and talk to me."
But they never did. And he was still crying when his throat turned to stone, like the rest of him.
Editor's note. That is, historically, where the tale ends. However, it's so terribly sad, so lacking in useful moral lessons, and so well known for leaving listeners in tears, that it's become a tradition among tellers to improvise new and less dire conclusions. I've taken the liberty of including my own here. Millard Nullings.
The animals tried singing and shouting to poor Cuthbert from the safety of their cliff-top, but they were too distant and their voices too small, so that even to Cuthbert and his giant ears, they sounded quieter than the whisper of leaves in the wind.
"Talk to me,"
he begged.
"Come and talk to me."
After a while, the animals began to feel very bad, especially the emu Raff.
"Oh, for goodness sake," he said, "all he wants is some company. Is that so much to ask?"
"I dare say it is," said the grim bear. "It's dangerous down there, and with Cuthbert turned to stone, how will we get back up to the safety of our cliff-top?"
"There's nothing that can be done for him," said the two-headed lynx, "unless you know how to reverse a witch's curse." "Of course I don't," said the emu Raff, "but that doesn't matter. We're all going to die one day, and perhaps today it's Cuthbert's turn. But we mustn't let him die alone. I wouldn't be able to live with myself."
It was more guilt than the other animals could bear, and soon they had all decided to join the emu Raff, despite the dangers that faced them on the ground. Led by the Raff, they made a ladder of their bodies, linking hands to ankles, and climbed down the cliff face to the ground. How they would ever get back to safety again was a question for another time. They ran to Cuthbert and comforted him, and the giant wept with gratitude, even while he was turning to stone. As they talked with him, his voice grew quieter and quieter, his lips and throat petrifying, until they could hardly move. Finally, he became so quiet and still that the animals wondered if he had died. The emu Raff pressed his head against Cuthbert's chest. After a moment, he said, "I can still hear his heart beating." The wren, who could turn into a woman, perched on the rim of Cuthbert's ear and said, "Friend, can you hear us?" And from his stony throat they heard, no louder than a puff of breeze,
"Yes, friends."
They broke into a cheer. Cuthbert was still alive inside his skin of stone, and so he remained. The witch's curse had been strong, but not strong enough to petrify him through and through. The animals were now poor Cuthbert's caretakers, as he had once been theirs. They kept him company, gathered food and dropped it into his open mouth, and talked to him all day long. His responses became more and more rare, but they knew he was alive from the beating of his heart. And though the wingless among them had no way to reach the safety of their cliff-top, Cuthbert kept them safe another way. They slept inside his mouth at night, and if ever hunters came along, they would climb down his throat and make howling noises that terrified the humans. Cuthbert became their home and their refuge, and even though he could not move a muscle, he was happy as could be. Many years later, Cuthbert's heart finally stopped beating. He died peacefully, surrounded by friends, a happy giant. The wren, who had grown up to become an Imbrin, decided they had become too numerous to continue living inside the stone giant, so she brought all the peculiar animals to a time loop she had made atop the cliff. She put the entrance to the loop inside Cuthbert. That way he would never be forgotten, and every coming or going was a chance to say hello to their old friend.
and whenever she or any of the animals passed through Cuthbert, they patted him on the shoulder and said, "Hello, friend." And if they stopped and listened carefully, and if the wind was blowing just right, it almost sounded like, "Hello." Millard Nullings is an accomplished philologist, a renowned scholar, and a former ward of Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. While in residence there, he earned over 20 correspondence degrees, authored the world's most comprehensive history of a single day on a small island, and helped vanquish a couple of truly nasty monsters. He is allergic to grimbear dander and almond butter. He cannot be seen with the naked eye. Ransom Riggs is the number one New York Times best-selling author of the Miss Peregrine's Peculiar Children novels. Riggs was born on a farm in Maryland and grew up in southern Florida. He studied literature at Kenyon College and film at the University of Southern California. He lives in Los Angeles with his wife, best-selling author Tahereh Mafi. This is Simon Callow. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tales of the Peculiar by Millard Nullings and Ransom Riggs. This program was directed by Garrick Hagen. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2016 by Ransom Riggs. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.